From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on May 7th in Milwaukee, where a 35-year-old man was jumped outside a Target store. The man had pulled a gun, but he never fired, and then he was pummeled by four other people, and all of this was a fight over trading cards. This has all gotten very weird, because this story is not a one-off. Target stores across the country have stopped selling trading cards for the time being, citing a risk to the safety of their own staff. It's baseball cards, football cards, even Pokemon cards. So what in the world is going on here? Well, during the pandemic, the trading card industry exploded due to a combination of factors. Yes, people have re-engaged with the hobby, but leading the way is the growth in something called grading, a more modern and sophisticated way of answering the question, is this card in mint condition? This is leading to a lot of money, a lot of money moving very quickly. A video went viral from the Miami card show recently where a 15-year-old collector was walking around with a case containing cards assessed at $500,000 in value. Some collectors have gotten so aggressive that they've been calling delivery truck drivers trying to get a jump on new shipments before they arrive in Target or other stores. Now, I have no idea what this means for all the old baseball cards you have in your basement. Possibly something, possibly nothing. We'll find out this hour. We want to better understand the way all of this works and why it has become such a hot business at this moment. Our guests include a card enthusiast of the first order and a man who's very, very good at his other passion, which is weather. Eric Sneidel is the WROC-TV chief meteorologist. Nice to have you on the program, Eric. I really thought we'd talk weather for the first time, but I'm looking forward to this as well.
Well, it's funny. I just heard the talk about the hurricane season started. I felt like that was where I was coming out here. But no, we got cards today.
Cards, indeed. And Steve Chatta is the owner of One of One Sports Cards and Memorabilia in Northeast Ohio, not far from where I am from. We got a lot of Cleveland natives on the program today. Hi, Steve. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. Well, listeners, we're going to try to answer some of your questions this hour. I already have a short pile via email, but if you've got questions on trading cards, you can send them our way at connections@wxxi.org. Let me start with Eric, and just can you walk me through where you are as sort of an enthusiast and a collector and how you got there?
Yeah, I was always a card collector, baseball card collector, ever since I was a kid. My dad got me into it. It was always something that I was just passionate about because I loved baseball. But that was where it ended. I would go and I would buy cards. I'd never sell them. It was never a business, nothing like that. As I got older, I started seeing things through a little bit of a different lens with it, where recognizing, you know, hey, there could be maybe some money to be made with this if you are smart and know a little bit about the hobby. And then, especially over these last couple of years, I started to get out of just baseball and do other sports, recognizing a little bit more of an opportunity to maybe make some money with it. And it's turned into still a hobby entirely, but one where now that things have exploded, certainly since the pandemic, you're looking around going, boy, thank goodness I was gobbling all these cards up through the years, because now things have gone through the roof. And now you're looking at this whole thing as more a side business, almost more than just a hobby.
Yeah. And Eric, to be clear here, you talk about exploding in terms of interest in the last year. I've had listeners writing to me since this morning when they knew we were going to have this conversation on the program saying, I cannot find Pokemon cards for my kids. I can't get cards anywhere. When did it hit you that things were at a totally different level with what's going on with cards?
I was listing cards on eBay for insignificant amounts of money about 2 years ago. And some of those cards now that were not selling at that point, I'm holding on to. They've gone up 1 to 2,000% over the course of 2 years. I can no longer walk into a Target or a Walmart. And I used to know exactly in those stores where the little sports card section was. They don't exist anymore. You can't find them anymore. And then when you do find them at other sources, the prices are jacked up so high, just the supply and demand out of this has gotten extraordinarily outrageous.
I don't understand one very sort of simple aspect here, which is that, Steve, when I was growing up, I liked baseball cards like a lot of people. I got fleeced on a few deals when I was 12. I learned the ways of the world that way. I spent too much for a Mike Schmidt rookie. But by the time I was an adult, it was clear to me that the cards that I had were not going to appreciate in value in the same way that most comic books were not going to appreciate all that much in value because the supply was so much. There, you know, in the late 80s into the 90s, what used to be rare comic books or a short print run and it was hard to find them, it was the same in all that stuff. You could collect it, but everybody down the street had them too. So even the Superman dies, the Funeral for a Friend comic books that we all thought were going to be valuable, Spawn number one, things like that, you know, it hasn't appreciated that much because everybody had them. There's just a huge glut out in the marketplace. And I figured baseball cards and basketball cards and football cards, to say nothing of Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Pokemon, would be in the same category with a few rare exceptions. Something has changed here. I mean, was I wrong in that assessment? Obviously I was wrong that these things would always be sort of not all that interesting or valuable anymore. What happened here, Steve?
So back then, when I was a kid, when you were a kid, there are certain situations where, you know, you and your buddies would go up to the store, go to the card shop and get cards. And like you said, everybody in that neighborhood would go get the same exact cards. So it was kind of oversaturated. Well, it wasn't kind of, it was oversaturated. Nowadays, they totally changed the game up. A company came over from Italy, Panini America, in the early 2000s, and started creating cards that had print runs. This was something that no one had ever seen before. In the mid 80s, late 80s, early 90s, everything was printed on a mass scale. Okay. Now, in the early 2000s, you had a card that was serial numbered on the physical card, numbered out of 100. So there was only 100 of those made. So you knew, or you know now, that there are only 100 of those cards being made. Okay. There's no question of how many are these things. You know, I have 15. Oh, I have 50. Now there are only 100, and they're serial numbered 1 to 100. So in the early 2000s, that's when the entire market, you kind of started seeing a change in the market where a base card was a base card, but now there are things that they call parallels. Okay, that's a card industry, you know, kind of a buzzword where it is numbered out of 100. It is short printed to 100. And there is a scarcity that everyone's looking for, and you can charge a premium for those cards now.
And so it is an intentional way for the industry to create scarcity. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Intentional scarcity. Yep.
Okay. And so Steve, when you are, as a collector, out looking, when I'm reading stories that say in the last year, the development of what's happened in a lot of stores like Target has gone something like this. First, the demand peaked, people started buying up everything they could find, then people started hanging around the store, the same groups of people, usually men, hanging around the store when shipments of new cards would come in. Then, in some cases, like we saw in Milwaukee, things got a little volatile. Then we had stories of people literally calling delivery drivers, trying to pay in advance to say, hey, don't drop off those cards at the store, I'll take them here. I mean, all of the stuff in the last year has exploded. So clearly what people have figured out is that if they buy a box of cards, they have a likelihood of getting a certain, they've gamed the number somehow to figure out how to make money. How are they doing it?
Correct. So there's two different ways of thinking here. It's either you're going to go to the store and you're going to spend $20 and you're going to open a box and you're hoping to hit that card that can make you a lot of money, right? Or you go to the store and you buy every box they have. So you now control the market and you can set the price essentially on those cards. So that's what everyone's doing. Panini, Tops, they send out these retail shipments. That's what you call the boxes that are sent out to Target, to the Walmarts out there. And you have these individuals going out there buying every single box. So nobody can find them. Well, like you kind of explained in the beginning, when COVID hit, you know, everybody flocked here to this industry because there was no sports, and the sports card world had no competition. If you think about it, casinos were shut down; no one was placing bets. Sports were shut down. There was no, you know, your backyard. There was no bookie. So sports cards kind of filled that void for so many people to invest in something tangible. Now, if everybody wants those and there are none left on the shelf, what happens? Price goes through the roof. And then people start fighting over it. Because if you can go to the store and any Joe Schmo can get a $20 box and sell it for $200 and you can get 100 of those, that turns into a could turn into a legitimate business at that point.
Wow.
For anybody.
Someday when they write the obituary of this country, they will look back at the time when Americans turned their lonely eyes to cryptocurrency and trading cards.
Mm-hmm.
but Steve, I want to talk about how this has impacted you. And, you know, so your business, I'm sure, you know, you're trying to be on the up and up, but there's this this underground market, right, where people are trying to buy up all the inventory and sort of control the supply and sell it. Like, how has it impacted you, and what are you doing about this?
Okay, so as a card shop owner, I honestly do not go out to Walmart and to Targets, and I just don't have time for any of that. So that stuff does get bought out. I have relationships directly with those distributors who distribute to Target and Walmart. I don't get as much product as they do, but I do get it, like a case or two of that product that's being sold. Now, at face value, I will sell I do something a little bit different than everybody else. There's some out there that do the same thing as me. So the first, let's say I get 20 boxes of a product. The first five I'll sell at initial release price. I'll raise the price a little bit for the next five, and then the final five. Now, what happens is you do have a lot of individuals who go out and buy out Target and buy out Walmart. I can tell you on a weekly basis, I get those individuals in my shop essentially pulling in a wagon of all of this product, trying to sell it to me at high market price. And I just direct them right back out the door because I don't want to support that much marginal increase in a product that's only $20.
Yeah, I hear that. Listeners may be wondering, you know, as they, all of our heads are spinning trying to understand just how much trading cards have been impacted by this surge in interest. Does this impact old card collections, or is this really about rare cards, Steve?
So this is the great thing about, and there's, again, there's always two ways of thinking. You have the old heads in the industry, like myself, my father, who sometimes think I'm on both sides. I like playing both fences, but who think like, oh, there's this new subset of this new demographic in the hobby who will only buy new cards. And it's great that, you know, we have an influx of customers in this, but they only like new stuff. Well, the influx of customers or the influx of people who buy sports cards is so large now that people can't help but look at their old collections. So regardless of what anybody thinks of that junk wax era, it's all getting looked at, right? So you have your Schmidt rookies. You have your Wade Bogg rookies. And what you were kind of alluding to at the beginning of the call is people are looking at those older cards, but they will only look at those older cards if they're graded. And that is extremely important when it comes to the older cards because, you know, there was a junk wax era back in the early 80s to the early 90s. But there was also a lot going on in those eras where people were finding ways to make copies of those cards and try to sell them or pawn them off as real. So having them graded or even in an authentic, holder is a really big deal to the collectors that were in that era that are looking to get back in.
Who grades? Do you grade, Steve?
So what it is, so there are two big companies out there right now.
Okay, explain grading. This is very helpful. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so there are two big companies out there right now, the two biggest companies who grade cards. PSA, they're in California, and there is another grading service called Beckett. They're in Dallas, Texas. They're the two monsters in the industry when it comes to grading. Now, companies like myself, we have customers bring cards in if you want your cards graded. I mean, Eric has done this a couple times when he's driven up into Cleveland. We will intake his cards and we send them out to PSA or out to Beckett for them to grade it. We're kind of a middleman in this situation. And the reason why we're a middleman is because if you were as an individual were to send it out yourself, it's a lot more expensive because we intake thousands of cards and send them all out at one time. Now, grading is very intricate. It's a very unique thing to do with a piece of cardboard, because you're then taking a piece of cardboard that could be worth, let's say, $100. And if it grades the best it possibly can, a PSA 10, that card could be worth anywhere from 10 to 15 times what you originally bought it for. And it's kind of mind blowing at how much you can increase your initial investment on cards like that. And now people are considering these graded cards as a portfolio now. If you think about it, they kind of think about these cards like stocks in a way, because they have their initial price, and then they send it out to get graded. And now you have an ROI, and the card industry has changed so much to where 10 years ago, I would never think of a card as that much of an investment, to be completely honest with you.
I mean, this is like, you know, 1990s wine futures when people realize that. I mean, it is. So in a second here, I'm gonna interrogate Eric about, you know, his portfolio, and I am fascinated by this. Steve, when I was growing up, I think the most we ever really thought about the way cards were described, it was like mint. There might have been like double mint, or there might have been like, you know, what was it? Mint. Yep. It was good, fair, excellent. I mean, it's a different scale now.
Yeah, so it's all a number scale, to be completely honest with you. And each of those numbers has a phrase that goes with those numbers. So you have mint, gem mint. But when you get lower, so let's say you have like a 1952 mantle, like a Mickey Mantle. That card may only grade a 2. But that might be the best grade of that Mickey Mantle ever, because nobody really grades. That's not true, but you can say
sure,
that
okay.
If you, there are some older cards, you know, that will never grade a 10. So if you get a 2 on a really old card, that could get you some serious, that can net you some serious coin in this industry, because those cards were never preserved back in the day. You had, you know, guys like my dad, we talk about it all the time. Guys like my dad were flipping them, you know, against each other on walls back, you know, outside the corner store back in the day. He jokingly tells me all the time how he put several Willie Mays rookies into his bike spokes and didn't care.
Oh,
and if we had those cards now.
It's painful to hear that story, man. But, okay. So I certainly understand the idea that older cards, you're not going to see a 10 probably. And if 5 is the best you get, then the value is very, very high. I get that.
Correct.
When you open a pack of cards today, are all of them 9 or 10? Are any 10? Like, what makes a 10?
So that's the thing. It's think of it as a car, like you're buying a car, right? You could go to Chevy or Ford or any or where you want to go to a dealership and get a lemon off the lot, correct? Every car that comes off the lot isn't perfect. Something could be wrong with it. So you got to think, they're still manufacturing millions on millions of sports cards, and it's all run by machine. So there could be, you know, if on a Tuesday the machine's off a quarter of an inch, that could mess the centering up on 100,000 cards, and none of those will get 10. And then you have to think, they're still machine packed. None of these cards, very few, are hand packed into the containers or the boxes that they go in. So if they're machine packed and that machine crimps a pack wrong, could damage every single card in there. It's very fascinating.
Okay. So I guess, Steve, then out of a typical pack of cards, how many, what percentage is a 10?
Nowadays they're so strict on grading that they want to kind of fix or correct the market. I'd say 5 years ago, a lot of things were tens. Honestly, they were really nice to collectors. Nowadays, it's tough to get a 10. In a pack of cards, you might get one, maybe. But also in a pack of cards, you might get 0 cards that are even worth sending out.
Sure.
You can open a pack of cards and just get
all common cards.
I mean, really, you commons and not want to send anything in.
Yeah.
It's all gamble.
Isn't it strange though, Steve, and somewhat concerning that Target has had to shut this down, and there are signs on their stores. People have sent me pictures around Rochester Target stores where they've got signs posted saying, due to protecting the safety of our staff, we're not going to be offering these cards. What do you make of that?
I think it's ridiculous. I even saw a story. I don't know what state it was in, but I did see a story where there was one of the manufacturer's delivery trucks actually had a tracking device on it in the wheel well. So somebody was tracking the delivery route, and it's gotten out of hand. It really has. And it's turned into a, like you said, it's a grown man's game. You're not seeing women out there doing this. It's a grown man's game. It's really, I think in the long run, it could hurt the industry. And the fact that kids aren't getting their hands on this is retail product in Target is it's meant for kids. They're $20 boxes of cards that generally don't have insanely expensive cards inside of them. So it's meant for, you know, you're out Sunday grocery shopping, you grab a box of cards on the way home, Johnny rips it, opens the box in the back of the car on the way home, and he has fun opening the cards up. And they're cheap, $20, $25. But the more that these Target and the Walmarts of our world are not putting these products out there, I think in the long run, this could really hurt the future of this industry.
I think that's a very wise point, and that's why I think about Pokemon, Steve. I mean, listeners might have heard at the top of the hour, I mentioned baseball, football cards, even Pokemon cards you can't find. Mm-hmm. And so listeners might be thinking, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, they're not going to be doing the same thing in Pokemon that they do, you know, creating these rare mint cards in football and baseball, but they do. So my son, particularly when he was 6, 7, a little bit when he was 8, was really into Pokemon and liked Pokemon cards. And yes, I have completed many Pokemon games and I know the rules. He didn't just get the cards to collect them. We played and it was fun. And it was fun sometimes to get, you know, some of the rare, more powerful characters and things like that. And then he started to realize that some packs of cards had not only the Pokemon that he wanted, but a shiny version or a, you know, these different kind of art versions of these Pokemon cards. And the more I read about it, the more I realized, oh my gosh, they've got it like marked and these are rare or these are ultra rare. That they're not doing that for the kids, Steve, right? They're doing that for the adults who are going to become collectors. And if the result is we're going to chase kids out of the market, then what good have you done?
Correct. And I think to an extent, it's showing young collectors that there's a fine line between this being a hobby and this being an investing game, right? So, and you could play devil's advocate and say this is showing younger collectors that, hey, look at, you know, this isn't like the 80s where you hoarded cards for years hoping they'd be worth money. These are worth money. So, you know, either they're going to be worth money now or later. And I do think, though, I agree with you. This could get rough in the future with pushing younger collectors, kids, out of the game because they're just not going to be able to get it. And if they do get it, it's only going to be on birthdays or Christmas because it's going to be – the price is going to be shoot through the roof.
Talking to Steve Chatta, owner of One of One Sports Cards and Memorabilia. Eric Snydel is with us, the WROC-TV chief meteorologist and a card enthusiast himself, talking about what's happened in the last year. Especially during the pandemic, the interest in trading cards has exploded, and this is an industry that now markets these rare cards. And some of these packs, sometimes one in a box, you'll get a rare or a super rare card. You can send it out to be graded for the quality. And if it's a high grade, all of a sudden, you can make a lot of money on this. So, Eric Snydel, when you think about your card collection now, do you think of it more as an investment, a portfolio, or do you think of it as sort of like objects of collectible fun?
Truth be told, I think it's sort of evolved into that, whether that was my initial intent or not. Just with the way the market has unfolded here, anybody who is sitting around with any kind of an investment here of cards, whether it was just for their own pleasure of the hobby of it, they just like doing it, you know, the same person now looks around and goes, well, you know, you're getting crazy amounts of money for these cards that I was initially collecting just for fun. I would be an idiot not to now almost become something more out of this. So to some extent, I think the market has driven where my head is at and in my space with this whole sports card collecting world, whether I wanted to or not. It is.
Okay, I take that point. And so if you are looking at your collection wondering, well, I wonder what I can get for this, or I wonder what the grade is on this, I guess you have to have certain cards graded. How often have you had cards sent out to be graded, Eric?
I have not done it often. I don't have a huge collection, but I had a small number of cards that became very high value. And, you know, looking back now, and it was just by happenstance, probably one of my best decisions I've made with this hobby was in 2017, I was collecting football cards. And in 2017, you had a draft class of Sam Darnold, Mitch Trubisky, Deshaun Watson, and a guy named Patrick Mahomes. And I just happened to luck into that year seeing, you know, there's a lot of big names here. Maybe this is a good year for me to change up. Instead of just treating it like a hobby so much, maybe I'll pour a little bit more in and try to get some of these big names. And it's a lottery ticket. It's luck of the draw. Patrick Mahomes became Patrick Mahomes. And, you know, you're sitting around now with a handful of cards of this guy, which, you know, at the time had some value. They've always had some value, but now it is different. And to some extent, you just lucked into that. But because of it, it's changed the way you now operate and the scope at which you look at this hobby.
So let me hit a couple of points on what you just said. Number one, so if you've got a Patrick Mahomes, I assume some of these trading card companies, they make common cards. So there's probably some Patrick Mahomes cards that are not all that special, I think. And then there's some that are rare and potentially very valuable. Is that a correct distinction, Eric?
That is correct. This is, to Stephen's point about the grading and the serially numbering, this is scarcity built upon scarcity. So not only do you have cards of anybody, not just Patrick Mahomes, that are numbered to pick a number that implies some scarcity, you now have an even lower fraction when you go out and get it graded. All of this is kept in a database of, let's say the card is numbered to 100, but only 10 of them were graded a 10. So now you've added even more scarcity on a scarce card. And that's where you've really seen a lot of this market take off, is in any facet or element that you can add to a card that already has some value that makes it more unique or more rare or more scarce. That's what is driving a lot of this explosion now.
Here in Western New York, there's a lot of Josh Allen fans. Are there Josh Allen cards that are fetching big prices?
I've got a buddy who we'll leave him nameless, but he a big Josh Allen fan, and he ended up buying a card, I want to say, for like $200 on eBay last year. That card is now probably 2,000% of what that initial investment was because of, number one, Josh Allen's performance. And that's a good point to make here, too, is this is not just simply a bunch of guys that have, you know, all gotten together and said we're going to drive up the card market for no rhyme or reason. A lot of this is based on the performance of these individuals. Poor athletes do not sell as well as athletes that are doing well. So a guy like Josh Allen, you know, Bills go to the playoffs. Allen is number two in the MVP vote. And guess what? Allen cards go up while the whole ambient market is also going up. So you get a nice double whammy there. But you get a card graded on top of that, and it gets a high grade. All of a sudden, you know, look out.
If we're talking about the same person who shall go nameless to protect his identity and really probably his life, I believe he bought this card as a gift for his wife, who could not believe he spent $200 on a card, and now is thrilled.
That was the story he told, yeah.
And now is thrilled that card may be worth a lot more money than just $200. You know, so Steve, if we're talking about a Josh Allen card that somebody bought a year or two ago for $200 and now you can get $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, that is hard for, I think, a lot of people to get their heads around. Is that common? Are those kinds of prices common for individual cards? And I don't mean common for common cards, but I mean for the rare cards, what are the biggest prices that people are getting right now?
Correct. So, and I'll just give you guys a couple, and just to clear the air, we weren't seeing prices like this 2 years ago, or, you know, 3 years ago. The prices that single cards are now graded cards are they're through the roof. They're astronomical. There's a little dip right now, but even this little dip that we're seeing is still astronomical. It's unbelievable. So just for an example, we had a gentleman come in. He opened one of those blasters, the little boxes from Target with his son, comes in, shows me the card. I graded it for him. It came back a 10, the best grade you can get. This was Sunday, and I just bought it off him for $5,000. This happens weekly. I mean, these cards are unbelievable. And very like Eric had stated, it is not only performance-driven, but it's position-driven as well.
Position-driven.
So it is position-driven. So quarterbacks throw touchdowns. Everyone loves quarterbacks.
Okay, I got you.
So quarterbacks always on the top of the pyramid, followed by a wide receiver or a running back. But quarterbacks are, in football, safest investment ever. They will always outsell anybody. And, you know, just like Eric said, you have one maybe MVP season or, you know, a quarterback like Josh Allen who takes the Bills to the playoffs and very similar, just like Baker, who took the Browns to the playoffs, very similar situation. Those cards see a 200%, 300%, 400%, 500% increase, not in their respective markets, but just across the board. It's unbelievable.
All right, two more quick questions, then we'll break, and when we come back, we'll just answer listener questions for the rest of the hour. First of all, Steve, when we say, well, this Josh Allen card's worth $4,000 or this graded Baker Mayfield card, because, you know, Baker's twice the quarterback that Josh Allen is, this graded Baker Mayfield is worth $6,000. That's only true if someone will pay that. Who is buying these?
So we use a database that is open to everybody to see the last sales of cards. And that database is driven by eBay sales. But like we were speaking about, you know, earlier in the call, the market has grown exponentially. There are not only individuals buying cards now, there are now hedge funds for sports cards. There are now investment groups for sports cards that have portfolios to where you say, hey, Eric, there is a $15,000 card. Me, you, and 13 of our buddies, 15 total, are going to all chip in $100 each, or $1,000 each, I'm sorry, $1,000 each to get to that total. We're going to hold it, and when we sell it, we all have equal shares. That's what I'm seeing that more and more with extremely expensive cards, and it's very intriguing.
My God. But most of the time, people are doing this as an investment strategy. I mean, if that's the case, then my conclusion about where the trading card market is, whether it's Pokemon cards, baseball cards, football cards, is similar to where Rochester housing may be for people who are paying $100,000 over asking for a house and then wondering if in 10 years from now they're going to have a hard time getting their money back for it, or people who paid $65,000 for a Bitcoin that's currently selling for $35,000.
Yep.
There becomes a diminishing returns point, and I mean, I know that I can't predict it, Steve. I mean, you and I, if we could predict it, life would be a whole lot easier. But it's possible that we are at the top of that wave and that people are going to look back saying, I cannot believe that I paid $1,000 for a share of a Josh Allen card with five other people here. Or maybe they won't. I don't know. I mean, are we at the point where people are going to start losing money on these investments soon, or do you think the market has room to grow?
So I think you're going to see less and less people willing to shell out, like one person willing to shell out tens of thousands of dollars on a card. Now, the sports card show that was in Miami with the teenager walking around with all those cards, that briefcase of cards, that was talked about in our industry. And that doesn't just happen in Miami. Dallas has a giant card show where people walk around with more than that. And what you're seeing now is all my buddies going to these card shows is, you know, the first, I'd say 7 to 8 months ago, you're seeing individuals buy 10 to 15 to 25 to even $100,000 cards at these shows. And they are making money on them if they do want to sell them at auction houses or anything like that. But now I think what you're seeing more is kind of what I alluded to just a second ago is you're seeing somebody take that risk and kind of spread it out over 15 individuals rather than one person buying those giant cards. So I do think there will be a time, there has to be, when cards are going to go back down. You can't stay this high forever. It's every market does the same thing. It's kind of a little roller coaster effect. I just think it's those people who will survive are the smart individuals who know exactly, you know, how to keep that portfolio balanced with not one giant, you know, pillar of a card. You build a house with bricks, not with pillars. So if you build a house with bricks and you spread your investment over hundreds of thousands of cards or hundreds of cards, whether you're a big collector or a small collector, then you'll be fine in the long run. It's those individuals who take the time out of their, you know, collecting lives or lives in general to buy one, two, three giant cards, and that's all they have. Those people, I think, will eventually get burned.
Oof. And Eric Snydel is someone who, you know, you've gotten into the investment side of things. One thing that comes to mind for me is a documentary series that I watched during the pandemic, which, as a gift to all listeners who have not watched McMillions, you're welcome, because it is hilarious and riveting and amazing. It's the story of McDonald's, the McDonald's game of Monopoly. If we all remember the Monopoly game at McDonald's.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
The McMillions documentary series with amazing human real-life people tells the story of how it was gamed from the inside, that there was somebody who figured out a way to get his hands on the rarest pieces that were the biggest prizes. And when those pieces would come off the line, he would be able to swap them out to himself and then replace them with common pieces. And then he would control where the big, big winners went. And it took a while for them to figure out this was happening. Eric, as someone who's interested in cards in this way, are you worried that somebody inside these companies knows exactly how many in a series of Josh Allen cards and the rare line is going to come out? They know where the cards are going to be. They know how to swap them out. There could be fraud of some kind. Does that worry you, Eric?
I think to some extent, there have been times where my mind gravitates to things like grading is a highly subjective thing. And you used to have people that would send a card out to get graded and not get the number that they want. They would crack the thing out of the case and then send it to somebody else and hope to get a better result, kind of a deal. So, I know nothing about whether any of that is actually transpiring, but that's just where my mind would kind of go when you're dealing with a human who is subjectively giving some implicit value to something. There's obviously room for error or room to question. I think for me, my bigger concern with this is just the cyclical nature of how any market
yep.
exists.
Yep.
The stock market, cryptocurrencies, everything goes up and down and corrects. And I think most people will tell you, when you look at this industry in a vacuum, that this is kind of ridiculous what folks are paying for pieces of cardboard with a chunk of jersey or a signature on it. I always have to step back and remind myself of, it's very easy to get caught up in. It's a lot of fun when things are going well. And nobody had to be smart or intelligent to make money over the last 2 years in the sports card market. You just had to exist in it. There will come a time when that will change. And it does. It worries me tremendously that is inevitable. But inevitable could be in a week, could be in 10 years. Nobody knows.
We've got some really interesting questions from listeners, which we're going to get to on the other side of this only break here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we discuss a new partnership offering mental health intervention services for Black and Brown victims of racial trauma and gun violence. The leaders of that initiative join us for the hour. Then in our second hour, we hear from two more candidates for Rochester City School Board. 9 candidates on the ballot this month. For 3 spots, your chance to meet them on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John from Canandaigua says, Evan, how do signed cards affect the price of a card? I remember as a kid hearing that an autographed card actually reduced the price, which never made sense to me. Again, that's John. Steve Chatta, can you take that one?
Yeah. Signed card, not as of right now. Signed cards are the best, to be honest. And it's really, like to each his own. So I am a huge fan of autographed cards. Now, all of the autographs nowadays, compared to back in the 80s, early 90s, they're all guaranteed certified by the manufacturer. Topps, Panini, Upper Deck, they all do a great job of having that kind of industry-wide stamp of approval. It was tough back in the day because nothing was really regulated in the card game. Everything was, you know, mass produced. It was difficult. But nowadays, everything is good. You're good to go. Now, the best of the best is an autographed card that's numbered, because now you have scarcity on that autograph. There are five. There could, you know, it could be a Marshall Faulk autographed card numbered out of five. There are only five of them that exist. So that manufactured scarcity is there.
Okay, so autographs can be helpful. John, interesting question there. I appreciate that. Barry wants to know, and I don't know if you can help with this one, Steve. Barry says, what do you know about Panhandle Scrap from Royal Bengals, Little Cigars, and Hassan of the Oriental Smoke Cards? These are trading cards from before most sports cards. Who would know their value now? Steve?
So I don't know those exact brands, but I am very familiar with Allen and Ginter, who was the original trading card out of Richmond, Virginia. Allen and Ginter is actually a product that Eric is very fond of nowadays, and I know this for a fact. Allen and Ginter is the original trading card. They're tobacco cards. They're very small. Typically, you got them back in the early 1900s in packs of cigarettes. To find out the value of this gentleman's cards, I would try to find them on eBay. eBay is the true marketplace of the industry. If not, a quick Google search. I'm not familiar with those brands. There were a lot of those brands in the early 1900s, even late 1800s.
How would you, if you had those, go about trying to figure out if they were worth anything?
So I would go on eBay. I would have the card in front of me. I would type in as much, be as descriptive as possible on eBay, see if I can find it. If not, you can actually go to, I'm guessing these are baseball cards, just a guess. You can actually go to Topps website and shoot their customer service line an email, and they're pretty responsive. They'll get back to you and give you as much info on that set, even if they didn't manufacture them back in the day, as they possibly can. They have a lot of industry experts that work in that customer service center.
Barry, good luck to you. Corey writes, oh, the stories I could tell you, Evan. My 17-year-old son is a true collector and part of this strange new world that few people know about. It is absolutely insane the lengths that some people are going, sleeping in parking lots to buy cards from Walmart and Target and resell them at astronomical prices. Sometimes my son makes more money in a week than I do. However, he is glad some of these changes are happening, like Target not selling. He doesn't like some of the ugliness he has seen the past few weeks and how tough it has become for young collectors to get into the hobby. End quote. That's from Corey. Can I ask both of you about that? I mean, Steve, you know, Corey's talking about her 17-year-old who's not technically an adult yet, making more money in a week than she makes sometimes, but now a little worried about how rough things have gotten. I mean, is this something you would urge a 17-year-old? And I'm not judging Corey at all. I mean, from what I know about Corey, great mother, great person. But is this something you would urge, say, a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old to get into? Or do you think it's a little on the edge right now, Steve?
I would urge them to get – now we're talking 14 to 17. Typically, maturity-wise, is a big difference.
Okay.
But if 13, 14, I would really encourage parents to be involved in it just because of where the industry's gone and what we have been talking about this entire time. And then try to find a local card shop to go to. You know, I really, obviously I own one. The card shops around Cleveland are very helpful to community members. So if you can't find something in the Target, your card shop will most likely have it. And they are more than willing to help you out, especially because typically card shop owners like myself, we've been around the block a few times and we know that customers are extremely valuable. So we will go out of our way to help as much as we can because we've seen this market, this industry go up and down and up and down. We've been in the gutter plenty of times.
Eric, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I don't think I have any apprehension about allowing a teenager to dip their toe into something like this. The only thing that would concern me somewhat is somebody who's 15, 16, 17 years old really has not seen anything but the boom that we've gone into. So, I remember several years back where I had a bunch of friends and buddies who got involved in Bitcoin, where it was running up to $20,000 and everybody was a millionaire on paper. And then guess what happened? It crashed. Well, nobody really thought about the crash kind of a thing. So I think if nothing else, it's a great learning opportunity for a lot of this younger generation. To Stephen's point, there is perhaps no better advice than getting your parents involved in it, who can bring you back down to earth and just reestablish, the way that this exists right now cannot exist in perpetuity. And as long as you're not putting yourself in a position here where if things don't go well in the future, now you're in a really, really bad spot, just somebody to put that all in the proper perspective. There's nothing wrong with this. It'll be a great learning experience, and it's still a great hobby.
Jason writes to the program, responding to the story that I read out of Milwaukee, the May 7th story in which a man was jumped out outside a Target store after a fight over football cards. Jason says, it is like that locally too, Evan. People were camping outside of Target and lining up early to get these cards. They are not collectors, but opportunists looking to make quick money. In Chilai, they had to put the cards at the service desk. Much of this mirrors the late 1980s and early 1990s card craze. The bottom fell out. A lot of so-called investments tanked. I mean, that's some of what Eric's talking about. And again, we don't know. I mean, Steve, it's possible that in 3 years from now, I talk to you and I say, man, remember when we thought that the bottom was going to fall out on that on those Josh Allen cards, and now a $4,000 card is $20,000? It could be. Or a $4,000 card could be worth $500 in 3 years. I have no idea where any of this is going. But the interesting thing to me is you're not necessarily going to be hurt as a business if there's a bit of a correction, because more people might actually have access to getting back into it, it sounds.
Correct. And I really like what Eric stated to the previous to his previous point, to where it does make me very nervous. And I never really thought of that. A lot of these new collectors, new flippers, new investors, they've only known the boom. So that kind of just have some wheels working in my head here. This is a very good point. And that kind of hits home too. To anybody new in this industry, do not be afraid to ask questions to somebody who has been in this for a very long time, because they know. Your card shop knows what happens when it bottoms out very well, what happens when it corrects. And just like stocks, Doge was through the roof, is through the roof now, and everybody thought they were, never into stocks, but now they were into stocks, your crypto. It's the same thing with sports cards, and that whole, I guess you could say, market blowing up. And if that's the only thing you know and you're not asking questions, that could really hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a few crypto bros who tell you it's only going to go up, up, up. It'll go up forever.
Yep.
And they're selling something you shouldn't be buying. There's always corrections. Joe wants to know, ask Eric if Bolt ever ate any of his cards.
I had a graded card that I came home to finding under two of his paws.
No
Thankfully,
way.
To the credit of PSA, they do a fantastic job of encapsulating these. And there was no damage to the card. There was some slight damage to the case.
Oh, my goodness.
So thank
gracious.
You, Bolt.
What is your are you able to divulge what is your most prized card possession right now, Eric?
I actually ended up, I sold my prized one to the other gentleman on the phone here about a month ago. I still have a relatively solid Patrick Mahomes card that's, it's a four-figure card. And I've got a Deshaun Watson that, pending his legal issues, we shall see how that plays out.
Okay. And lastly, Andrew writes to the program to say, Evan, I've got the old Billy Ripken card. Is it worth anything? I'm going to be very careful here and just let listeners know, Billy Ripken, didn't he mean Cal Ripken? Now, this is Cal's brother, Billy. And my recollection is there was a famous card in which Billy Ripken was holding a baseball bat. You could see the bottom of the bat. And on the bottom of the bat was quite a colorful piece of profanity that somehow snuck through the printing, or the conspiracy theorists say was allowed through as a joke. Anyway, Andrew wants to know is that if that is worth anything. Steve Chetta.
So with the profanity showing, that was mass produced. So that really isn't worth too much.
Okay.
And it's worth a laugh. But this is one of the very few circumstances where the card manufacturer actually acknowledged an error and tried to correct it.
They put a black box over it, right? They put like a little black box over it?
So here's the thing. So they put a black box over it. Those are worth a little bit of money. But if you get one that has a navy blue box, those are the ones that are worth a bunch.
Oh, my gosh. And real quick, Steve, settle the mystery. Did they let that through on purpose?
There's no way you can't let that go. There's no way you miss that. I think they let it go through. I think they did. I can't say for sure, but
because they were wagering no publicity is bad publicity, so we're going to let
exactly.
This Billy Ripken profanity card go through. I have greatly enjoyed the conversation, even if I don't fully understand all of it. But I feel like I understand it a lot better now, thanks to Steve Chetta, who's the owner of One of One Sports Cards and Memorabilia. Steve, thanks for making the time and for educating us on this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eric Snydel, WROC-TV Chief Meteorologist. Next time we talk, let's do weather.
I got to go to work now anyway.
Yeah, man. Hey, you really do outstanding work. We're lucky to have you in Rochester. It's fun to watch you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan.
Eric is really, really outstanding at his job, and he's a card enthusiast. Don't lose your shirts out there with this stuff, everyone. Have fun with it. Rob Braden, Emma Ray Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.